Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Well, any parent reading the headlines about, say, social media scandals in young women or the so-called hookup culture or sexting is bound to panic. Author and journalist Peggy Orenstein did. So she started doing what she does best. She began interviewing people. She met with more than 70 young women between the ages of 15 and 20, and their stories are in Orenstein's new book titled Girls and Sex: Navigating the Complicated New Landscape. Peggy Orenstein joins us from Chicago. Welcome, Peggy.
Thanks for having me on.
I want to ask our listeners also, what questions do you have for Peggy about teenage girls and young women and their sexual relationships? Do you think young women are being objectified more than they have been in the past? Are they being objectified even by themselves? Are they giving too much and getting too little? And, of course, what about young men? You can call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. You can also find us on Facebook and on Twitter at Radio Boston. So, Peggy, let's start with you. What did you set out to find here, aside from just abating a little bit of parental panic? And how was that different from what you may have learned?
Well, you know, one thing was we were having this huge national conversation about consent when I started doing this work, this huge conversation about assault. And what I really wanted to know was what happens after girls say yes? Because, you know, honestly, consent is a very low bar for a sexual experience. It's very important, but not having been assaulted is a very low bar. Mm. So I wanted to sort of go out, talk to girls, see what was going on. As you said, I'd been hearing things about the hookup culture, about binge drinking, about sexting, about all these things. I'm a mom. You know, my kind of initial desire was to just stick my head in the sand. But, you know, parenting from ignorance and fear, not the best parenting strategy. So when I have questions like that, I like to go out and talk to, you know, 70, 80, 90 people and see what they have to say. And I wanted to bring the voices of those young girls back into this book and surface them and have them tell their stories so that I could start a conversation that I felt we needed to have desperately and weren't having about how kids can engage ethically, responsibly, safely, reciprocally, and enjoyably.
Okay, so we want to talk about what you heard from these women. And, you know, I couldn't help thinking just initially, every generation, right, thinks, oh, yeah, this next generation is going off the rails. You know, there's too much sex going on. So what are the big differences now that you heard from these young women compared to, say, a generation or two ago? Tell us, if you can sum it up, I know that's difficult, but what do you hearing from these women about what's sort of a common thing in the sexual landscape?
You know, there was this real disconnect between a sort of public power that these girls have. And I should probably back up here and say the girls that I interviewed, although they spanned a broad ethnic demographic, the main stories in the book are there's African-American girls, Latina girls, Asian-American, white, Arab-American. They were all pretty much middle class, most of them, and they were all either college-bound or in college. And I chose that group particularly because I wanted to talk to girls who had opportunities and who we think of as the beneficiaries of the feminist movement, because if those girls who had an expressed public power, a voice in the classroom, political forthrightness, all of these things, who were, you know, basically leaning in, were still toppling in their private lives, then we knew we had a problem. So one of the girls that I spoke with said, you know, I come from generations of strong women. My grandmother's a firecracker and my mother's really strong. My sister and I have, you know, are really loud and we see that as feminine power. And then she kind of detailed a series of hookups that had were her sexual experiences that were unsatisfying, non-reciprocal, vaguely demeaning. And she said, you know, I just think we girls are socialized to be sweet and deferential and not express our wants. And I said, wait a second.
What about that firecracker, right?
Yeah, what happened to the strong woman you talked about a minute ago? And she said, she kind of hemmed and hawed and she said, you know, I think I didn't know that that strong woman image applied to sex.
So why is that? I mean, what's happening here? And would you say that's the pervasive feeling that these women don't assert themselves sexually?
Yeah, you know, I think it's a complicated thing. But one thing that you have to recognize, I mean, I put this in a social justice framework, and I talked about this idea of intimate justice that Sarah McLachlan, who's a professor at University of Michigan, developed, which is looking at this as, you know, just like doing the dishes is political, right? Just like laundry. I mean, it's personal, but it's also political. And when you talk about sex, you have to look at who is entitled to engage, who's entitled to enjoy the experience, who's the primary beneficiary of the experience, and what good enough means to each partner. And with girls, from the get-go, we create this disconnect between the image that they're supposed to present in public, which is a very sexualized image that focuses on the hot, and complete silence around the realities and the capacities of their bodies and their sexuality.
So, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Oh, I was going to say, so, you know, just to elaborate on that, when children are born, parents tend to name all boys, baby boys' parts. So, you know, at least here's your pee-pee something, right? Mm-hmm. And with girls, we tend to go right from the navel to the knees. And there's no better way to make something unspeakable, you know, than not to give it a name. And then girls go into their puberty education classes and they learn that boys have erections and ejaculations and they have periods and unwanted pregnancy. And you see the, you know, that internal diagram that looks kind of like a steer head with the ovaries and everything. And then it grays out, right, down between the legs. So you never say vulva, you never say clitoris. No surprise, fewer than half of girls have ever masturbated. And then they go into their partnered experience. And how can we expect them to have any sense of voice, any sense of entitlement, any sense of agency in their sexuality? And, you know, it's not just about, like, you know, girls deserve to get off or something like that, but you know, I don't think we want girls' early sexual experiences to be something that they have to get over.
Do you think that from talking with these women that there's a lot here that we could spend hours unpacking, but I'm wondering, did these women not have an understanding of their bodies and their sexuality? Did you find that when you were talking with these women? I mean, yes, maybe it wasn't done correctly and maybe they weren't told enough, but do you think that these women were lacking in understanding?
Well, I think the thing that was really clear was that, first of all, we tend to define sex to kids as being just intercourse, and that denies and marginalizes the other activities that they're engaged in, particularly oral sex, which is one of the things that has really changed in the big rise in both the activity itself and also the idea that it's no big deal when it's done female to male. And when we don't talk about it, we make it into not sex. And when it's not sex, it's not subject to the same rules around coercion and consent, around respect, around reciprocity, around caring. So there was a lot of one-way activity going on, girls to boys. And after listening to that a lot, and girls had a lot of reasons for doing that, you know, this very kind of performative idea of sexuality, I started saying to girls, you know, what if every time you were with guys, they said, go get me a glass of water from the kitchen, and they never offered to get you a glass of water? Or, you know, if they did, it was super begrudgingly, like, okay, I'll get you a glass of water, you know. you wouldn't stand for it, right? And they would laugh like you just did. And they, you know, and they would say, well, when you put it that way. And I'd say, well, maybe, you know, you should think about what it means that you're less insulted by the idea of getting glasses of water for somebody than performing a sex act.
Hmm. Well, I want to remind listeners, if you have a question for Peggy Orenstein about teenage girls and young women, you can call us at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. You can also find us on Facebook and on Twitter at Radio Boston. I'd like to go to the phones right now and take a couple of calls. Lise is calling from Truro. Lise, you're on the air.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Your question.
So my question is, it seems to me as a parent from the outside looking in on their lives that there is a whole lot of hookup culture going on. There's all this pornification of identity and the kids doing these crazy dress-up selfies. And so there's this sense that, you know, they're having a lot more sex and there's more casual sex happening at younger ages. Is that something that is just an impression or is you finding that that is in fact happening?
Okay, Peggy, is that true?
In fact, if you're talking about intercourse, the age of first intercourse has not changed. there are more, as I said, other forms of behavior. And the issue that you bring up about the kind of pornification of the culture was really salient. And what that does over and over, this idea of hot, you know, that has become like the only, you know, you're just striving to be hot no matter what else you are. And hot is so narrow and so superficial and, you know, it's such a commercialized idea of sexy and attractive. And it tells girls over and over that how their bodies look to others is more important than how those bodies feel to themselves. And the girls that I talked to were really wrestling with this. They were wrestling into the pop culture. They were wrestling over, you know, the impact of porn on their sex lives. They were wrestling about all this sort of externalization of the self that they were going through. And one girl said to me, isn't it possible to dress, she used the word slutty, isn't it possible to dress slutty because you feel good about yourself and you don't need validation as opposed to not feeling good about yourself and needing validation? And I said, yeah, maybe. So tell me the difference. And she sort of drooped and said, I don't know. I spent half my life trying to figure that out, and I feel like it's at the expense of my own well-being.
Hmm. Now, you talked about pornography briefly, but I'm wondering, that is something that's very different. The ease of young people accessing pornography. How might that be affecting this whole picture here?
Well, you know, pornography is another. Obviously, kids get it younger now. See it younger now. They see more of it, and they see more explicit types of pornography than there was in the pre-internet era. And they bring. There was a survey of college students in England that found that 60% of them said that they consult porn in part as sex education, even though 75% of them knew it was about as realistic as pro wrestling. So they're looking at it to see how things work, and. You know, porn, with the few feminist porn sites maybe aside, is there for male gratification. And it's another place where women's bodies and women's sexuality is a performance for men's pleasure. And so girls would say things to me. They would ask questions comparing themselves to a porn star sometimes. They would say, my boyfriend, I heard this repeatedly, my boyfriend wants to know why I don't make noises like the porn actresses or porn stars, they would say, when we're having sex. And sometimes I would just, you know, my journalistic remove would drop and I would say, look, it's a movie. And in a movie, there's a soundtrack. If they didn't make noises, it would be a silent movie. You know, it's not real. It's not real. But they were bringing both the aesthetic of porn and also the activities of porn and the expectations of porn into the bedroom. And that was a problem for boys, too, I think, that boys felt pressure to be a certain way, act a certain way, show a certain form of masculinity, which is why, as you said in the beginning, it's really important that we talk to boys about these issues, too.
Absolutely. Well, we will get to that, but we first want to make sure that we get to the phones because we have lots of folks waiting to ask you questions and to weigh in here. Carlton is calling from Millis. Carlton, you're on the air.
Hi, I just want to reinforce what Peggy said about girls viewing oral sex or other forms of sex other than intercourse as something to get through. I'm a psychotherapist. I've been one for 4 decades. I was interviewing some girls for a book I did about 7 years ago and on teens. And in this discussion, there were 10 girls ages 12 to 13. They were talking about a bar mitzvah for a boy. They're all upper middle class Jewish girls that they had just been to. This was in the Bar Mitzvah boy's basement. The girls were asked to perform oral sex on the Bar Mitzvah boy as well as the other boys present. These girls did. I asked them what they felt, what they thought, and unanimity responded, it was awful, but we got through it, and at least we won't be called prudes anymore.
So that was it. As long as we're not called, the pressure to not be called a prude is enough for them to sort of get...
No enjoyment, but the pressure's off.
And I'm interested, Carlton, why you think that there's a disconnect. Peggy said she wrote this book deliberately talking with young women who would be beneficiaries of the feminist movement. No one sounds like a beneficiary in this scenario to me. What do you think is going on?
I believe what's going on is what Peggy has been referencing and what's been referenced by many folks, and that is the objectification of girls and women being the supplicants for male pleasure. But it has reduced itself, as she indicated, at such a low level. I mean, this is, I'm 40 years into this profession, and what used to be troubling or vexing for 16-year-olds and 17-year-olds not that long ago is now vexing, here I'm referencing 12 to 13-year-old girls. So it's the same pressure to satisfy the male, although they, you know, can take some sexual pleasure from it, but at later ages. Those ages of 12 and 13, it was just get this prude label moniker off of my back so I won't get hassled and be the only one who hasn't given oral sex. And it's the same thing that happens with little girls wearing, you know, underwear that says hottie on the back of it. And I'm talking about 7-year-olds. So that's it in a nutshell.
All right, Carlton, thanks so much. So, Peggy, what do these women say about the fact that there may not be a lot of reciprocity in their intimate relationships?
Well, you know, they talk about the reasons, as Carlton said, about why they're willing to perform. And sometimes it's exactly that, because they don't want to be called prude. They're trying to find this balance between two negatives, the prude and the slut, and figure out where they can stand. Sometimes it's to improve a relationship, to gain popularity. Sometimes it's because they themselves, you know, as I said, we don't name, we don't discuss, we don't talk about girls' sexual pleasure. We don't talk about their agency. And so they don't feel very comfortable with their own genitals themselves. And they, you know, I was always interested in kind of places where there was, were sort of symbolic opposites. And one of the things girls would talk about with oral sex was the shoulder push, which was the kind of silent push on the shoulders that boys would do to them to, you know, indicate what they wanted. When boys tried to reciprocate, some of them would talk about doing the armpit scoop, what I started calling it, which was coming up from below to direct them towards safer, if less erogenous, ground. So there was a combination of the pressure to perform and also a kind of reluctance to have that reciprocity. And also the other feeling that girls would say was that they sometimes felt a sense of power when they were performing oral sex for that moment, when they had a guy in their control, as opposed to not wanting to feel out of control or like they were being done to in other sexual acts.
You said you started this in, as there was a huge conversation going on about consent and assault. How do these attitudes on the part of young women and young men play into that whole debate on when no means no and what's happening?
Well, you know, when we normalize coercion, it makes it difficult when, you know, when girls' limits become something that are to get past. It becomes difficult to find the voice to be able to say no, and difficult, and conversely, boys are pressured not to hear no. So I think it was really important to surface what was going on in the consensual relationships, to look at how those played into the complexities of the assault culture.
You know, we had a very high-profile assault case here in New England at St. Paul's School in New Hampshire,
right.
And the it was surprising to me when you read the comments of the news coverage of that there were so many people who were actually sympathetic with the young man who was accused of assault in that case, even though there was something called a senior salute, where apparently many of the young men who were at that high school were supposed to try to get as many female sexual conquests as they could before they graduated. And it didn't sound like it was obviously healthy. But there was an awful lot of sympathy for the young man accused on the part of parents who were saying, look, this is the culture that's surrounding these young boys. So I wonder, how do you deal with educating young boys? Because obviously they're half of the equation here.
Right. You know, and that case was very classic in that regard. It's typical that parents, that adults line up behind the boys. And also the girl who kept saying, I didn't want to hurt his feelings. I was, you know, I froze. Girls are always talking about not wanting to hurt boys' feelings. And they need to be told, you know, when somebody is not respecting your limits and boundaries, you don't have to be polite. But one of the, I end the book in a co-educational classroom where kids are really working these things out together. And I did that on purpose. And I also end with an image of a boy as well, because I wanted this to be, and a lot of, you know, parents of girls have boys. But obviously, boys, too, need to be hearing these messages about the impact of sexualization, about reciprocity, about ethics, about caring. And, you know, there was one boy in the class that sort of partway when we were talking about the baseball metaphor, you know, running the bases as sex. And he sort of stopped and said, wait a second. In baseball, there's a winner and a loser. So who's supposed to be the loser in sex? Mm. And it was just this, for me, this really tremendous moment, because, you know, it was just a little moment, but it was a big shift in that boy's head to have that moment and have that thought. And I thought, you know, I think in some way now he will go into his relationships, whether they're 10 minutes long or 10 years long, more as a partner and less as an adversary.
Okay. And so we need to ask, are you still panicking, Peggy? And what do you tell parents who might be listening to this conversation and panicking? You know, how do they help their young girls and boys navigate this?
I'm thinking more constructively now, less than panicking. And one thing that really moved me when I was doing the research was looking at the way that Dutch do sex ed and the way that Dutch talk to their kids. There was a study comparing Dutch and American college students, and so, you know, similar demographics. And they found that on every measure, whether, you know, the negative things, pregnancy, disease, consent, sobriety, that Dutch did better, regret, there was less regret, and all the positive messages about satisfaction, about mutuality, about being able to talk to your partner, about your body image, about taking pleasure in your sexual life, about delaying sexuality and having fewer partners, Dutch way above the Americans. So something they were doing was so much better than us. And what they found was that parents, teachers and doctors talk very explicitly and frankly to kids from an early age. And particularly the difference was that American parents, while they're just as comfortable or perhaps uncomfortable talking about sex as Dutch parents, tend to emphasize risk and danger, whereas Dutch parents talk about balancing responsibility and joy. And so for me as a mom, I thought, you know, up until that moment, I would have thought, I've talked to her about contraception, I've talked to her about disease protection, I've talked to her about consent, I've done my job. And, you know, I don't feel that way anymore. I feel like that's only half the conversation.
All right. Peggy Orenstein is author of the new book, Girls and Sex, Navigating the Complicated New Landscape. Her previous book is Cinderella Ate My Daughter, Dispatches from the Frontlines. Peggy, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Stay with us. Coming up, we take a look at some of the forgotten poems of Bostonians at the start of the 19th century. I'm Deborah Becker, and this is Radio Boston.